Last time we were talking about strict complementarity of DNA. What is that? What does it mean? Strict complementarity. Right. It means adenine and thymine always go together. Cytosine and guanine always go together. And that is the reason why DNA is able to replicate. Because that is how one strand of DNA can serve as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand. And so once we knew that, then a big question is, how does replication actually proceed? By which of these three possibilities, basically? There's three models here, and one of them must be true if you're going to use DNA as a template for building new DNA. Either the conservative model, the semi-conservative model, or the dispersive model. The conservative model, which is fully conservative, means that when a new in another generation, when one cell splits into two, one of those cells will have completely the original DNA. That's what's conserved or saved. That's why this second cell has both strands original material. Dark blue in this whole slideshow means original DNA, and light blue means new DNA. Whereas the other one gets completely new material, right? They really should have used three colors to make that shown here, but notice that the original, fully both original strands are conserved in each generation for one of the cells. Semi-conservative means half conservative, which means if that's true, then each cell will get one original strand and one brand new strand to make up its double-stranded DNA. That's why each DNA here in the second cell is one dark blue strand and one light blue strand. Okay? The only other possibility is the dispersive model, which is also the most complex. And therefore, you should expect it to be the least likely to actually be true, because what happens in nature by natural selection is the easiest stuff to happen, basically, the most parsimonious, as it's called. But anyway, the dispersive model is mathematically possible, so it has to be considered as well. In the dispersive model, each strand is cut into bits. New complementary pieces are made, and then all those bits are put together so that each strand in a double-stranded helix is partly old and partly new material, as you see here. Okay? So the question then is, which of these is true? And trying to determine that, of course, requires a scientific experiment that's well-designed, which is summarized in slide 11. They used labeling here as well, but this is not radio labeling that they used, like in that previous experiment I talked about. Instead, they used different isotopes of nitrogen. Nitrogen, of course, is in DNA because it's in the nitrogenous bases. N15 and N14 are both nitrogen, but N15 has an additional neutron in it compared to N14, so it's a little heavier. And therefore, you can detect the difference between something that has N14 in it and N15 in it by using centrifugation. In centrifugation, when you spin it to create G-forces, the heaviest things go to the bottom, right? Therefore, N14-containing stuff will be above N15-containing stuff in the tube. That's how they could keep track of it. So what they did was grow bacteria for several generations in N15-containing medium, and then they put some of those bacteria into a medium that had no N15 and only N14. So that's what they had to build their new DNA out of. Okay? Then they subjected it to centrifugation. And you have all three models listed here, but think about what the predictions are for each of these three models. For the conservative model, you should have a completely original double dark blue helix in some cells and a completely new double light blue helix in other cells, right? Therefore, you should see two bands in the centrifugation tubes. The newest stuff is lighter because it's the N14, and the N15 is heavier, so it should be below it. You see how that corresponds to the prediction, or to the model itself? Well, the red X means that didn't happen. So right away, they refuted the conservative model. That's not true, that's shown. But they couldn't tell whether semi-conservative or dispersive is true from this first test, this first generation. Because even though they happen differently, they have the same prediction with respect to the centrifugation tubes, right? Each DNA is half old and half new, just in different ways. And therefore, it should be just one band, and that's what occurred. So they can't tell just from one generation which one of those is true. That's why they then did it a second time. They gave it another generation to produce another set of cells. And the semi-conservative model predicts now to be two bands, right? Corresponding to these little pictures. Whereas the dispersive model should still just be one band. It would be higher up because it's getting lighter and lighter as more and more N14 is incorporated, but it should still just be one band. And they didn't see that. They saw the two bands. So, pretty well-designed experiment to clearly indicate that the way DNA replication actually happens is via the semi-conservative model, not dispersive or conservative. Well, once you have that tucked away as a fact, then the question is, how does it actually happen? How does replication happen? And that's what we're going to study in the next several slides, starting with 12. Now, there is a dichotomy with respect to cell type that we keep talking about, right? Prokaryotic cells are different from eukaryotic cells in various ways. One way that matters as far as replication is concerned is in their chromosomes. And I've already mentioned that difference, right? That a prokaryotic cell has a single circular chromosome. And therefore, that chromosome doesn't have any ends or beginnings. It's a loop. On the other hand, a eukaryotic cell has some number of chromosomes, which is determined by the species. It depends on the species. And each of those chromosomes is linear. So it has two ends. Well, that makes things happen very slightly differently, but it's very similar whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic. Prokaryotic replication is shown on the top, eukaryotic on the bottom. Starting with prokaryotic replication, though, notice that we have one circular chromosome. It consists of two dark blue strands. Dark blue means the original material. But this is really an oversimplification. Even though it's a single circular chromosome, it is still a double helix. So it really would be wrapping around all the way around the circle, but that would just be too confusing to look at, which is why it's simplified as a non-helical double-stranded circle. Anyway, a circular chromosome doesn't have any place to start, as it seems that, you know, it seems like it doesn't have any place to start. You could start anywhere, but there is actually a specific place on the circle where replication begins. That's represented by the two black dots, one on each strand. That's a specific sequence that the cell actually recognizes as the place to start. And that's called the origin of replication, because that's where replication originates. Now keep in mind that each of the two major functions of DNA, which are replication, which we're looking at here, and transcription, require reading the code, which means each of those functions requires splitting the two strands from each other, breaking those hydrogen bonds. And that's what happens first at the origin of replication, during replication. In other words, at the origin of replication, the two strands get separated from each other, and that forms this more or less football shape called a replication bubble. And that involves breaking hydrogen bonds. This is what I was talking about last time when I said it's important for the bonds holding the two strands together to be weak so that they can be broken. That one football shape, which is one replication bubble, has two pointed ends, just like a football. Each pointed end is called a replication fork. So there's two replication forks in one bubble. And notice the light blue material being added here. Once you have the strands separated, you can read the sequence in each of the two strands, and using the complementarity rules, lay down new material complementary to the original material. That's what the light blue strands represent. And that happens for both of the two strands, and they get the replication bubble gets bigger and bigger, which means the two original strands get more and more unzipped at each fork. You can see that the forks in this real replication bubble in the photomicrograph. Until you've gotten all the way to the other side of the circle, at which point you are done replicating, and notice what you have here. You have two complete double-stranded chromosomes, circular. Each one is identical to the other, and they're also both identical to the original one you started with. Also notice that they're semi-conservative. Each one is one original strand and one new strand, dark blue and light blue. That's how it happens in a prokaryotic cell. Very similar process in a eukaryotic cell, meaning that a replication bubble is also involved here. Now, when you think about a eukaryotic chromosome, which is very long, and that's why this represents just one of however many chromosomes there are. The same thing would be happening for each chromosome in a eukaryotic cell. But this isn't the entire length. That's why it fades off at the ends. It's very long. When you think about it, though, you could use the same process of using one replication bubble like a prokaryotic cell. If you start in the middle of the length and open up the bubble, you would just make the bubble bigger and bigger until the forks got to the very ends. That would work, but it would be much slower that way. What happens instead is that there are multiple origins of replication spaced apart all along the length of the chromosome. And simultaneously, each origin of replication forms its own replication bubble, so that each bubble only has to get big enough until it runs into the next one. And you can get the whole thing replicated in a lot less time that way. But fundamentally, it's the same process as what happens in a prokaryotic cell. And when you're done with that, once again, just like for the prokaryotic cell, you have two double-stranded chromosomes, identical to each other and identical to the original one, and each of the two daughter chromosomes is... Or pieces of DNA, I should say. They're not called chromosomes until they're compacted. But anyway, each one is half old and half new material, semi-conservative. That's just a quick overview. It doesn't really show you any molecular details, so that's what we'll go to next in slide 13, starting in slide 13. Once again, dark blue indicates original DNA, and light blue, not shown here yet, will indicate new material. There are multiple proteins necessary in the process of DNA replication, and all but one of those are not only proteins, but specifically enzymes. One of them is a protein, but it doesn't act as an enzyme. Anyway, we'll consider these in the order in which they do their jobs, basically. We're looking at, though, before we talk about the proteins, let's orient ourselves. We're looking at just one replication fork of one replication bubble. The bubble is bigger and would go off to the screen to the right here and have another fork over here, the other end of the football. And everything that's happening in this one would be happening in the other side as well. The first job, if you're going to do this, is to separate the strands at the origin of replication. And that's already been done, but that job is completed by the first protein to work, which is the green one here called helicase. Helicase is named after the fact that it works on the double helix. But helicase separates those two strands by breaking the hydrogen bonds between them. Notice the arrow, though. This helicase is, after it has separated the two strands, it moves along and unzips the strands more and more at the fork. Now, there's a problem with this. Why were the two strands held together to begin with before helicase came along? Very slight. Called hydrogen bonds, right?
Right.
And not only were there hydrogen bonds, they were hydrogen bonds that were perfectly matched to each other because of the complementarity of the two strands. So that's what holds them together, right? You can break those because they're hydrogen bonds. But if you then get out of the way and the helicase moves, what's going to happen? If you pull the two strands apart and then let go, what's going to happen? They're going to go right back together because they're perfectly matched up with their hydrogen bonds. And that would undo what helicase is trying to do. So helicase, as it moves, will unzip further and further, but you need another kind of protein, and this is the only one that's not acting as an enzyme. The gray ones in this figure that are called single-strand binding proteins, those come along and temporarily clamp on to the strands, keeping them from going right back together. Now, just like helicase moves, the single-strand binding proteins move as well, but they're behind helicase, keeping the bubble open up long enough for the next protein to do its job. They're just basically clamping them open rather than allowing them to close. Yeah. No, they don't cease to exist at all. They still have those partial positive charges. A, T, C, and G have either two or three partial charges, depending on which nucleotide, and those still exist. And when they get into contact, when they get into proximity with the other one, the complementary one, they'll go right back together for the same reason that they went together to begin with. A hydrogen bond is not a chemical bond. It's simply a slight force of attraction between slightly positive or slightly negative parts of molecules because of unequal sharing. All right, now the single-strand binding proteins are keeping the strands apart. That allows for the pink thing, which is the next protein, to do its job. And as you can see, its name is primase. It is named for the fact that its job is to lay down what's called a primer, or more specifically, an RNA primer. This red thing is the primer itself, as you see. Now, a primer is really just a short sequence of nucleotides. So instead of calling it a polynucleotide, you would call it an oligonucleotide, just a short sequence. But those nucleotides that the primer is made out of are RNA nucleotides, not DNA nucleotides. And so you might be saying, what the hell is going on here? You're trying to make a DNA molecule, right? Why would you start by putting down RNA nucleotides when you have to have DNA in the final product? Well, the answer is that you wouldn't if you didn't have to. But cells don't have the ability to lay down DNA nucleotides onto nothing. In other words, DNA nucleotides can't be the first thing that are put down. A cell can add DNA nucleotides only to nucleotides that are already in place. On the other hand, RNA nucleotides can be laid down first, onto nothing. And that's what the primer is. Those are the nucleotides that are already in place then that you can add DNA to one at a time to make it longer. You just can't put DNA down first. So primase lays down RNA primers. Another thing that this figure shows, other than the proteins we've been talking about, is something that's really important to understand, especially for the rest of this, or the slides that are coming up. Whenever you are building a polynucleotide, which can be either DNA or RNA, we're looking at DNA here, but when you build a nucleic acid, what you're doing is making a polymer, one by adding one more monomer at a time, right, to a growing strand. For nucleic acids, the only way that can happen is if you add the new nucleotide to the 3' end of the growing strand. You can't add it to the 5' end. So you have to understand fully the idea of anti-parallel in DNA structure. Before any of this happens, you just have DNA, two strands held together, right? But they are held together in an anti-parallel arrangement. Each individual strand has a 5' end and a 3' end, like we've already covered, right? Anti-parallel means that the two strands are in opposite directions with respect to each other. So my fingertips, for instance, would be the 3' ends. My elbows would be the 5' ends. Not like this. It's like this. That's anti-parallel. So when you build a new strand, when you separate these two strands, you're working just with one original strand, you're building a new strand on it, that new strand also has to be anti-parallel to the original strand. So notice that this top blue strand, it's 5' on the left, 3' on the right. Therefore, the new strand that's being built has to be 3' on the left, 5' on the right. But, as I was saying before, when you make this longer by adding nucleotides to it, you can do that only at the 3' end. So this strand has to grow in this direction. It'll be reversed on the other strand, right? But each new strand is anti-parallel to the strand it's using as a template. Okay, the only protein that we haven't discussed in this slide is the blue one. That's called topoisomerase. This solves a problem that you can understand by analogy with a rope. Can't really tell that this is a double helix because it's been simplified, but it's a double helix. Most ropes are more than two strands, but just imagine a two-strand rope coiled up, helically wound. If you had that connected to the wall at one end, for instance, and then you were standing here and trying to separate the two strands at the other end, you could do that fairly easily. But what happens is the more you do that, the more tightly wound the rest of the rope becomes, until eventually it's so tight that you won't even be able to separate it anymore. Same thing is happening as helicase moves down farther and farther. You're getting overwinding upstream here. And eventually that would be too difficult to overcome and helicase would come to a stop. So you need this separate enzyme, topoisomerase, to be moving ahead of the fork and every once in a while make a cut in the DNA and more or less let it flop around to relieve the tension and then seal it back together before helicase comes along. Then helicase will still have an easy job of separating it. Okay? That's all the players in the game for that slide. Let's go to 14. The dark blue here, as before, is the original DNA. So that's the template strand. Because it's called the template strand because that's what's being read. The sequence is being read so that you know by rules of complementarity what the sequences in the new strand being built have to be. And the light blue is the growing strand. Now, some growing has already occurred here. These nucleotides have already been added one at a time. And it's growing downward in this figure because that's the 3' end of the growing strand. That's the only end you can add new nucleotides to. Okay, now, what does the word nucleotide mean when I say that? What do you know you have if you have a nucleotide? Yes, how many of each? No, I mean, it's one sugar with 5 carbons.
Right.
You're correct in saying that a nucleotide has a nitrogenous base, it has sugar, and it has phosphate. How many of each, though, of those? No, not I'm talking about one nucleotide. When I say nucleotide, that tells you there's how many nitrogenous bases in that one nucleotide. There's one nitrogenous base, right? How many sugars?
One.
And how many phosphates?
One.
You can't tell from the word nucleotide. That's where I was leading. Nucleotide is an ambiguous word. That's why in a previous chapter when we were talking about ATP, which is a nucleotide, it's not as descriptive to call ATP a nucleotide as it is to call ATP a nucleoside triphosphate, because that phrase tells you exactly how many phosphates there are. A nucleotide has one or more phosphates in addition to the nucleoside. Remember that the nucleoside is simply the nitrogenous base and the sugar. So nucleoside monophosphate tells you there's one phosphate. Nucleoside diphosphate tells you there's 2. Nucleoside triphosphate tells you 3. They're all nucleotides, though. That's why the word nucleotide doesn't give you all the information. Okay, so for replication, you want to add a new nucleotide to this growing strand. But notice that each of these nucleotides that are already in place, that are part of the strand, each of these is a nucleoside monophosphate, right? Because there's just one phosphate in each nucleotide, as you saw in your puzzles. But the thing that's coming in as the new piece, the next monomer to be added to this polymer, is not a nucleoside monophosphate. It's a nucleoside triphosphate. Why would you do that when you have to have in the final product a nucleoside monophosphate? Notice that 2 phosphates are being taken off of this so that there's just one left, which is what you need for it to be a monomer or part of the polymer. Why not just start with a nucleoside monophosphate and add it? Exactly right. Just like we take phosphates off of ATP to release energy, if we start with a nucleoside triphosphate and take off phosphate, that provides the energy for building this bigger molecule. The creation of a polymer out of smaller subunits, hopefully it will make sense to you that that is an expensive process, right? Energetically, that is endergonic. So you can't start with a nucleoside monophosphate. You wouldn't have the energy required to hook it on to the other piece. Starting with a nucleoside triphosphate provides the energy as long as you cleave off 2 of those phosphates, which is exactly what happens, leaving just the 1 that will be incorporated into the sugar phosphate backbone of the growing chain. Now, it shouldn't surprise you at this point that doing this, which is a chemical reaction, adding a monomer to this polymer, is helped out by a specific enzyme. So that's the next important protein in this process, the one that is shown in the orange box. DNA polymerase, but actually there's different versions of DNA polymerase. You don't see that here, but this specific DNA polymerase is DNA polymerase 3, Roman numeral 3. It's obvious from the name that it's an enzyme, but even if it had a different name that didn't end in ASE, you should still be able to tell from this figure that it's an enzyme. Why is that? Because what? Kind of, but more explicitly what I was getting at is it is not written on either end of the reaction arrow. Only reactants and products are on either side of the arrow, right? An enzyme is above or below the arrow to show you that it's not a reactant or a product. So DNA polymerase is the enzyme responsible for adding a monomer in the form of a nucleotide to the polymer that's growing, which is the growing strand, at the 3' end. And it gets its name because that process of building a polymer is called polymerization. Polymerase is the enzyme responsible. That involves cleaving off 2-phosphates. So, you know, when you use ATP, which is an RNA-based nucleotide, for energy, like we've been talking about in previous chapters, usually you cleave off just 1-phosphate, right, to make ADP, providing energy for something. Here you cleave off 2. And, so in other words, this bond is broken right here. That will leave 2 inorganic phosphates still hooked together. That's called pyrophosphate, 2 inorganic phosphates still linked. That doesn't last very long, though, because pyrophosphate will then break apart into 2 individual inorganic phosphates, and that'll just become part of the phosphate pool that's always in cells being used for, you know, next moment it might be part of ATP. All right, 3' end only. You can't do this at the other end. And also notice the anti-parallel. This new strand is anti-parallel to the original strand. 3' end on the bottom for the new strand, 5' end on the bottom for the original strand. Let's then go to 15. On the top figure, you have an overview of a single replication bubble. That would be the only one for a prokaryotic cell, but for a eukaryotic cell, there would be many of these. But anyway, a single replication bubble includes its 2 replication forks, the points of the football. That's where the unzipping is occurring. And the new material that's being laid down is being produced in 2 categories of strands. Get different names. You have the leading strands, diagonally situated, and you have the so-called lagging strands. Now here's where, to understand this, really it's important for you to realize what I've told you about only being able to add to the 3' end, never to the 5' end. Okay, so let's look at the middle part of this figure. This top original DNA strand is 5' on the left, 3' on the right, of course. The new strand that's being built is therefore 3' on the left, 5' on the right, anti-parallel. This is the so-called leading strand, which is easier to build and therefore it happens more quickly. That's why it's leading. The lagging strand has a problem that takes a little bit more time and so it lags behind. But this is the leading strand right here. The reason it's so easy to build the leading strand is because the direction in which the fork is opening is the same direction in which the building of this new strand is occurring. This is the 3' end, so that's where the new nucleotides are being added. And as the fork opens up more and more, it just keeps adding and gets longer and longer. You see that? That's not what's happening, though, meanwhile, on the other strand at this fork. You don't see the one being built here yet, but we will in a minute. This other strand, the lagging strand, has the problem that its directionality is reversed, right? This original bottom blue DNA is 3' on the left, 5' on the right. So this new strand, which would be the lagging strand, has to be 5 prime on the left, 3 prime on the right. Correct? You can only grow in the 3 prime direction, though. So this strand is going to have to be built toward the right, whereas the fork is opening up toward the left, behind it, not in front of it. And therefore, the lagging strand has to be built a little piece at a time. The leading strand just requires one primer. You lay that down first, and then since the fork is opening up in the correct direction, you just make it longer and longer. But the lagging strand, this one was put down first when the fork was just opened up that far. You put down a primer and then make it a little longer. Then you open up the fork a little more until there's room to put another primer down, and you build, you add more DNA till you run into the previous piece, and so on. The little fragments that a lagging strand is made out of are called Okazaki fragments. After a biologist who discovered them. Okazaki fragments are the individual pieces that make up one lagging strand. Each Okazaki fragment requires its own primer. But do you see the problem? You see how that's different from the leading strand and why it has to be in a piecewise manner? Okay, good. We've talked about some of these proteins already, but let's look at them again. This fork is getting bigger. Not shown here would be primase, the pink one in the previous slide, that put down the RNA primer to begin with. And then the orange one here is DNA polymerase 3, as I said. That does the job of adding one more DNA nucleotide at a time to the 3 prime end. Same thing's going to happen involving DNA polymerase and primase for the lagging strand. It's just going to take multiple primers, because one per fragment. The green one works first, though, to unzip it. That's helicase, and the gray ones are the single-strand binding proteins. All right, 16, this is just a close-up of the previous slide's top part. You can see it better. But also, the fragments are now numbered. This is the order in which they're built. This one was built first, like I said, when the fork was only open this far. Then you open it up a little more so you have enough room for another primer to be put down, number 2. And you only have to extend it until you run into the previous fragment, and so on. Those are the Okazaki fragments of the lagging strand. That takes more time, and that makes it lag behind the leading strand. But eventually, it's all built. 17 shows you Okazaki fragments being built with the enzymes involved. Each fragment, as I said, which is this piece, that's one fragment, this is another fragment. Each fragment requires its own primer, and therefore primase has to work a lot harder for the lagging strands than it does for the leading strands. But this is review here. This orange one is simply DNA polymerase 3 elongating the growing strand by adding DNA nucleotides. Well, once it does its job, DNA polymerase 3, and primase has already done its job of putting down the primers to begin with, then all the holes are filled, meaning you have as many nucleotides as necessary, right? This is what I mean by a hole. There's no nucleotides there yet. Once you have all the nucleotides in place, though, you're not done. There's a couple problems still. One glaring problem is that some of those nucleotides are RNA, right? Every primer is RNA, not DNA. And that cannot be left in the final product. You're trying to build a DNA molecule. So getting rid of those RNA primers is something that needs to be done, and that requires its own enzyme. This is another version of DNA polymerase. It's DNA polymerase 1. The yellow one here. It goes along the new strand, and for each primer that it recognizes, it removes the RNA nucleotides And it replaces them with the correct versions, the corresponding versions in DNA nucleotides. The job is still not complete, though, because DNA polymerase 1, even though it's able to do that, is not able to make, once it removes this final RNA nucleotide, it's not able to make this final phosphodiester bond connecting it to the other chunk. That's why you see this little nick in it right here at the bottom. So it has to, of course, be a continuous strand. You can't leave these little nicks in it. And so the final important protein in the process is the teal one down here, which is called ligase, or DNA ligase. That's called that because it ligates, or ties together. Which is exactly why ligands are so called, right? Ligands are things that bind to or tie to something. So ligase is named for the fact that it, however many fragments there are, it will sew them all together end to end by making those phosphodiester bonds, completing the sugar phosphate backbone, in other words. Okay. 18 is really just a review of all of this in one slide. So the first thing to work is helicase. It's already done its part of its job here, but it starts at the origin of replication when the two strands are still together, separates them by breaking the hydrogen bonds, and then unzips the fork as it moves along. Single-strand binding proteins temporarily clamp the two strands apart from each other so that the next thing can come, which is primase, to lay down the primers. One per leading strand, several per lagging strand, one for each Okazaki fragment. Each of those primers has a 3' end, which is the only end that DNA nucleotides can be added to, and doing that job is DNA polymerase 3 for either the leading strand or the lagging strands. There's a leading strand on the other off-screen part as well, but it would be on this bottom part. And there's another lagging strand, which would be up here, just like you see in the overall figure. That will fill in all the holes, but then DNA polymerase 1, the yellow one, has to come along, recognize the RNAs, remove them, and replace them with appropriate DNA, and then DNA ligase comes along and sews them all together. By the time you've done that, you have a completely replicated DNA. Well, actually, I should say you have two replicated DNAs, right? Because each original strand is going to now have a complete new strand. That makes up one double-stranded DNA, and the other one is a double-stranded DNA as well. Two copies. All right, that's the basics of DNA replication. Now we're in slide 19, and it's pretty amazing how well the mechanism works, meaning how few mistakes it makes. It does make mistakes, but not very many, especially compared to things like factories or, you know, other things that do things repetitively. If you had an error rate in a factory of 1 per million, that would be really doing a hell of a job in the factory, right? A million's a big number. But consider that each individual chromosome, which there's many chromosomes within a cell, is itself millions of nucleotides long. That means if you had an error rate of only 1 in a million in a cell, that you would still be making multiple errors for each chromosome. And errors can be bad, right? Those errors are called mutations. Well, not only is the error rate pretty low to begin with, but it's made much lower by the fact that cells are able to recognize most of the errors and repair them right away. This is part of the so-called proofreading mechanism that cells have. They make the new DNA, but they also check it for errors, and if they see errors, they correct them. So the effective error rate is much lower because of that. still, errors do happen. Plus, they can happen later after replication exists or is complete. And those are mutations. Those accumulate throughout your life. Like I was talking about in cancer, that's why cancer is so much more prevalent in old age. You've had a lot more chance for accidental mutations to occur. Anyway, the proofreading mechanism, part of how it works is shown here in slide 19. The top piece of DNA has an error in it. It's a defect. Notice the little bulge on the top fragment. And the little piece, the little black line between these two nitrogenous bases, that's a covalent bond that occurred between them, which should not be there, right? Within one strand, the nitrogenous bases, whatever they are not connected to each other. That's the sugar phosphate backbone that is connected to each other. The nitrogenous bases are supposed to just be hanging off. But it's possible for them to create a covalent bond, especially if you have two thymines, two T's, right next to each other in the same strand. And the sequence can be anything, so you have two T's next to each other frequently. Chemically, though, it's especially easy for that to happen when you have two thymines. And that covalent bond that's formed is called a thymine-thymine dimer, involving two thymines. This can happen pretty easily when exposed to ultraviolet radiation from sunlight. This is one reason why sunlight causes cancer. It causes defects in the DNA. Cancer is defective DNA. You've lost control of the cell cycle. Well, anyway, the cell can recognize these thymine-thymine dimers, usually, and correct them, involving yet another enzyme, or a group of enzymes, really, a category called nucleases. And these nucleases function for what is called excision repair. The verb form of excision is excise, which means to cut out. Ex means out. Size like in scissors. What the nuclease does, basically, after recognizing that this is a defect, is make two cuts, one on either end of the defect, and remove or excise that defective sequence of DNA nucleotides. Now, that removes information, of course, right? But no problem, because the other piece, the other strand, is still intact. And even though you remove this, you can still look at this other strand to figure out what DNA nucleotides need to be replaced in order to make it right. So it's using rules of complementarity again. But nuclease doesn't do that. Nuclease just cuts it out. Then DNA polymerase 1, the same one that was removing the RNA nucleotides, the RNA primers, comes along and fills in the hole with the correct DNA versions based on the complementarity with respect to the original strand. It still, though, is not able to make that final phosphodiester bond, so you need DNA ligase then to come along and sew it together. But if you do all that, then it's like the dimer never formed. The DNA is back to being normal. All right, 20. There's a problem that is the topic of slide 20, but it's a problem that prokaryotic cells do not have. Only eukaryotic cells have this because of the fact that their chromosomes are linear and therefore have two ends. The problem that I'm talking about is because there are ends, and therefore a circular chromosome doesn't have this problem. The ends of a eukaryotic chromosome, each end, is called a telomere. Remember, centromeres were somewhere along the length. That's where the two chromatids are held together. Telomeres are at the end, telo meaning far. Now, look what's happening in this slide. This is the end of one strand of the original material, the 3' end. Nothing beyond that. This is the end. Well, primase can come along no problem and add a primer there because you can add RNA onto nothing, right? That's the reason you need primers to begin with. So no problem there. And once you have the primer, DNA polymerase 3 can no problem add DNA onto it. And also no problem, our DNA polymerase 1 can come along and do its job of removing the primer, like it does for the other primers. But it can't do its job of replacing the RNA with DNA. Look at this other primer, the one that's not at the end. Once it's in place and the DNA is built on it, DNA polymerase 1 can come along and remove this primer and add corresponding DNA because this DNA to the left of it already exists and it can build onto that. But when you remove this one, there is nothing here to add on to fill in that hole. So DNA polymerase 1 can only remove the primer. It can't replace it with DNA. You see why? Okay, well, that means every generation, same thing's happening to the other strand on the other end. Every cell cycle, every generation of cells in a eukaryotic organism, the chromosome gets a little bit shorter because of this, which obviously could be a huge problem, right? You're losing DNA every generation. Well, this is not necessarily a problem right away, because a lot of the sequence of a DNA is not coding for anything. There are so-called non-coding regions. We haven't talked about much about genes yet, but we will. A gene is really just a subset of the overall sequence. The overall sequence makes up the chromosome, the whole piece of DNA, in other words. A gene is just a subsequence within that sequence. And so a gene is here, another gene is here, and you have a sequence between them that doesn't code for anything. The genes are the coding regions. So if you have a non-coding region at the end, it's no big deal if you lose that. But you lose a little bit more every generation, so it doesn't matter it doesn't matter, eventually you're going to be eating into the gene itself after a certain number of generations, which would doom the species, right? It would make it extinct. That hasn't happened. We're here, so obviously there must be a way around this. This is kind of analogous to film. Projected film, which isn't used anymore, right? You go to a movie nowadays, it's a digital version that's projected. But in the days of film, you had a projector that you had to load with a reel of film, right? And one long film strip on one reel is like one chromosome. When you put that into the projector, you have to load the end of it into the projector, and doing that over and over, which you would have to do for a really popular film, it's being shown a lot, is damaging to that end. And it gets hard to load it in, so what they would do is snip a little bit off. It's no problem, because that part is called the leader. It doesn't contain any frames of the movie yet. It's just blank film that they can erode away. But if you do that enough times, eventually you're going to cut into the frames of the movie itself, which are like the genes of a chromosome. They are important. You can't remove them and not have any effect. So, since you would eventually be cutting into the genes with this problem of the telomeres, eukaryotic organisms have evolved a way around the problem. And that involves still another enzyme named for the telomeres called telomerase. What telomerase does in eukaryotic cells is to just add a dummy sequence of nucleotides. It's always the same sequence. It doesn't have to have any DNA that it reads to add it. It just adds it as a chunk. And that's really more or less a fresh liter of film. And then you can erode away at that without causing any problems. Then it'll add another one later so that over generations we don't become extinct for that reason. Yeah.
Why can't the RNA go back?
This isn't a problem with RNA. The RNA can be removed, but you can't replace it with DNA because there's nothing here to add. See, when this one's removed, this DNA has already been in place by the time it's removed. So you can fill this space in with DNA by adding it onto this. But you can't here because there is nothing to the left of it. All you can do is remove the RNA and leave it open. And similarly for the other strand on the other end, it would be the bottom strand that's getting shorter on the other end. '21 and '22 are the last slides in the show, but they combined make up one figure from the whatever book this was from. You can see that 21 leads into 22. And also this whole long panoramic figure changes the viewpoint as you go from left to right. We're zoomed in on the left edge, and then we're going out, zooming out, looking at it from a wider angle as we go toward the right. But what's being illustrated here is the way in which DNA is organized with proteins to make it manageable within a cell. It's pretty astounding how much DNA we're able to pack into cells. But keep in mind that every one of your living cells, except for your red blood cells, which don't have nuclei, contains a full library of DNA. All of your genes are in all of your cells. Well, a cell is microscopically small, so small you can't even see it. But the DNA that's in just one of your cells, if you stretched it out as a line, would be over a meter long. All of that into an invisible cell. And even more impressively, not just into the cell, into an even smaller nucleus within the cell. And you double it in the cell cycle, so there's even twice the amount for part of the cell cycle. Well, doing that requires efficient packaging. And that's what this slide is all about. So on the left, you see just the naked DNA. But you already know that it's not just DNA alone that occurs in the nucleus. It's chromatin, right? Chromatin is DNA plus proteins. And as you see here, those proteins are many copies of histones. Each individual histone looks more or less like a human sperm, but it's just a protein with a globular head and a tail hanging from that. Well, if you take 8 copies of these histones and group them together like you see right here with the heads all grouped together and the tails radiating out from the center, then you have built what amounts to a hose reel. And you can wrap some of the length of the DNA several times around that hose reel. Go ahead.
Are the tails also flat?
No. They're just part of the protein. Yeah, this is much, much smaller than a flagellum, because a flagellum is part of a cell. This is miniature compared to the cell. The cell would be bigger than the campus in this view. So there could be millions of these things within one cell. Okay, but anyway, this one hose reel, with however much of the DNA is wrapped around it, is called a nucleosome. And then you have a length of unwound DNA between it until you get to another nucleosome, and so on. So it has this beads on a string appearance. That, just by itself, really makes it a lot more compact. Right? Because you're reeling it up. And when chromatin is not condensed into visible chromosomes, like we've talked about, that's all you would have, really. In other words, the DNA would still be accessible because you need to read those genes, so it can't be too compacted. But when you get later in the cell cycle, when chromosomes finally appear, it's more than just these nucleosomes, beads on a string arrangement. Once you have the nucleosomes, then they get aggregated or grouped together in what is shown on the right edge of this figure. which makes it a lot more compact. But you can see that the DNA is getting harder and harder to access. That's why it's not like this until you're ready to divide. At the right edge, that's continuous with the left edge of 22. And that forms a much thicker band, basically. But as we zoom out even more, we see that that already compact form is then looped back and forth many, many times to make it much more compact in the form of a really condensed chromosome, which is when we use that term. So that's why it all fits. That is that chapter.